Even though doing things with your mind is also fun for me. But there's like, how to say, there's sort of like, there's a difference. There was a time where I actually like started a university, like I started a bachelor in philosophy. I didn't finish it. And I couldn't stand it. Not because of the field, but because of the way it was presented. It was like long distance and lots of reading material. And some of the material was presented in such a way that to me seemed so pointless, so useless in a way, because it wouldn't tell me what I can do with it. And therefore it was frustrating because I need to figure out what I can do with something so that I can actually engage and learn about it. And I found a later entry into that field then, by finding some literature that was kind of starting out with that, with, well, what's this actually for? Like, what can you do with it? And so therefore I think maybe there is a time, like you said, very early on, where we get civilized, where society has very strong input on us. And I mean, like, we're like insanely flexible and impressionable in our developmental process. Where it seems to be that we learn that this kind of engagement isn't right, isn't how we're supposed to do stuff. I'm thinking even on the very basic level, I remember, and that would have certainly been like less of a mystery if I had known that I was autistic or if my parents had known that I was autistic. But when I was in kindergarten, I remember times where I wanted to touch other kids. Like, I needed to see them with my hands. I needed to like feel them and sort of grab them and like, push them around or like have them sort of, I needed to like experience this other being. And that's how I remember it, like, like sort of wrestling around and kind of like physical play with my parents was like one of my most favorite things in childhood. And I loved that my dad could do that with me. My dad was really, really tall, so it was the best living playground I could have. I know it's something I did on a daily basis. Like I would in the morning run over when he was like not even away yet and mean like jump around in his bed and mean like, can I climb around on you? Because like, that was something that was essential, I think, to my growing up learning experience. And, speaking of like the more, let's say, commonly known somatic level, like if we look at stuff like somatic therapy, we go like, yeah, okay, so we can work on emotional releases through certain things where the idea is that we experience an emotion through our bodies, right? Whether it is like punching a punching sack or pressing against a wall or whatever. We even had before somatic therapy was much, much present, there was like sort of a craze. I don't know if that was everywhere in the world where it got really popular that people would go to junkyards and like trash a car with a sledgehammer or something. And that was somehow of a cathartic experience. And when you put that in the press, in the like context of somatic philosophy and what we've just said about the body needing something to be able to, it's like there's a link between the body and the rest of our minds and experience. And if that gets put together, it's almost like a multiplier for our experience. And then I think that gets removed. I think that's like a slow, long, ongoing process of civilization, like you say, from very early on, that kind of like starts pushing us away from engaging with the world that way. And maybe I was fortunate in some ways through being autistic that that push wasn't strong enough for me to let go. And then for a long time, it can be experienced negatively, right? Like, I mean, I'm bringing up all these like fun and cool sounding experiences, but it was in many like in many points in my life that was a point of confusion for me too, because the level of physical engagement that I needed to make sense of something wasn't provided. And so that can be really disorienting. And sometimes I feel reminded of that when I hear the experiences of people saying like, yeah, how do you know how to do something, right? Like, how do you know how to relate, for example, to get like a prime area of challenges for many, many people. And yeah, I'm having a little bit of like a problem because there's so many fractals coming up in my head that I don't really know where to go. Like, you know, that makes me think of, like you say, the 20th century and certain conventions that came about that very strongly glorify the purely mental engagement.
But glorify the mental engagement and everything else that was not just not worth anything, but it was downright shameful.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like sometimes, I mean, that's like maybe that's like a little far-fetched, but sometimes I feel like you know, there's almost something that by the pure experience of growing up the way many of us do, and like again, I don't want to generalize this too much, but like let's just say a certain percentage maybe experiences like this, that by the way that they grow up, a certain part of their motor of being, of the, you know, like a core piece of the experience of being a human, gets trapped along the way and like locked away in like a little box. And what I noticed is like where that connects to for me, like memory-wise and experientially, is there was a time I did a lot of parkour and free running, and I was teaching that together with my brother. And there's a point that I could almost observe in anybody that ever came to our course, where some of the stuff that we were learning was very scary for people. But I feel quite proud of like saying that, you know, with his help very much, we managed to find a way of teaching people sort of very slowly towards that threshold, that where you need to kind of, you know, that's the feeling of jumping off a cliff and not knowing where you land. Internally, I mean, not externally. Then all of them were in their own time coming to the point of making that jump. And so the philosophy behind parkour is very strongly like it's very constructive. There's no peer pressure. There's very high like discouragement of pressuring others or comparing, and very much encouragement of making your own step size and not doing something unless you feel safe in it. And I really like that about, you know, their approach and their philosophy. And watching that in people felt, and I can't say look because it did feel like watching that little locked up part getting out for the first time. And then, you know, immediately after, like, I don't know, the feeling of they first time jumped off a block on a mat and did like a backflip, or you know, managed to like unlock something in their bodies that let them like stretch that 5 centimeters further. That is just a mental thing when you jump over something. They have these gigantic smiles on their head, and they kind of, you know, they radiate this aliveness. And that I know from my own experience of doing those things where I had the same blocks and everything, that to me it felt like that, and it seemed to echo back from watching them, that it felt like part of my somatic wisdom that was underdeveloped because it got locked away came alive again, and suddenly I was able to incorporate that in my life experience. So yeah, I feel like not only is the civilization doing that possibly for a lot of people, like you say, you know, starting to almost disable us to engage with that, but also is possible, like it's probably a good idea to keep in mind that when we start engaging with that field, and that's certainly how I experience it. I have to start to engage on the level that I probably was at like 2 or 3, you know, when it started to be locked away very sort of subtly. And I can't just jump in and expect to be really good at it, which is kind of like, you know, it's like picking up any skill, but I think it's important to keep in mind that somatic philosophy is also, amongst many other things, a skill where it can be detrimental to not be aware of having that space and creating that space for yourself when you start engaging with something, that it's something new and you have to sort of do baby steps, you know?
When you're talking, I'm thinking about the from the 2 to 3 years or something that you this is where you have to start when you begin. And then I'm thinking about what I said about my 1-year-old who has such who experiences everything with her entire body. And I'll just expand that to even to mixing this to this kind of natural baby-like synesthesia, where you mix all of your senses always connected, and everything is and that is the when you said that learning language and learning words was like a physical experience for you. So this is kind of the I remember very clearly when my friend Dana in Israel was going to teach me some basic Hebrew when I was there visiting her long time ago. And the way she taught me how to say warm and cold, she we used the entire body and like when hum, you know, like I'm waving my hand in front of my face. So this is like the movement I have with hum. It's too so, too hot and kar, I'm like shaking it with cold. So this is so this so when so the somatic intelligence is a kind of maybe an awareness of how the senses are or we learn that the senses are separated maybe. This is another 20th century thing, the necessary separation of everything all the time and how things don't go together and you know we're everyone is alone and the but this is yeah maybe I'm wait I'm thinking.
There is an interesting intellectualization that happens with language too, or with some languages at least. Like, so I just speak German and English, and like I have, I don't know, a layman's, I can speak like 3 or 4 words of Japanese, but the even in just like that sort of tiny selection, there's kind of like some things that stick out to me where it's like, you know, like you can say, oh, I feel cold. And then if you're like thinking about it, it's like that's not really a feeling, like per se, it's not an emotion, it's a sensation. But we're saying, I feel cold. And there's lots of points of that where I think it could point, this is a complete speculation, but it could point towards like, you know, us developing a way of speaking that could show that we weren't actually willing to accept that part that you just mentioned about the way you learned to speak Hebrew. You know, that there is a sense thing, because like you said, there's like a big portion of culture that sort of puts shame on sensation and shame around the body. And so it would make sense for me that, well, maybe that also influenced how our languages developed, you know, and we would say feel instead of like sense. I mean, we still like some people rather say I am cold than I feel cold and so on. And so it's not an absolute thing, of course, but it makes me think of like, yeah, what about this separation? Because even when we talk of our senses, to me, that doesn't seem to encompass everything that I can somatically experience. Like I can't always like when I try to describe a somatic experience, I often feel lost for words because I don't have a way of being like, yeah, how do I even words this more complex, more deep thing? It seems almost like language can kind of be obstructing, and by language being obstructing, if we think in language, that can even be obstructing, like on a conceptual level.
Yes, totally. This is very interesting. There's this psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan who had this huge theory about how language the about the gaps that language create, the lost paradise that is forever beyond your reach in the same moment that you can say it, you know. So this is very, very interesting. This is another conversation, I think, but about words and the way also the words are kind of magical when you can sort of you call forth things with words, just like you call forth a rhythm with your body or with drumming you on with your hands, and you know it's very. It's very interesting when you start to talk about to think about how just anyone's interaction with the world and with other people and with how with even I'm spreading my arms right out now because what I want to say is what I want to convey is the feeling of my very Miriamness reaching tips of my fingers.
Yes,
That,
exactly. It's so much wider and deeper and three-dimensional,
yeah.
unlike words.
Yes.
And it makes me think kind of like, what you said earlier about your one-year-old. It's they don't have words. Maybe that is partially, good in that sense. Because maybe the learning of words, like if I go back to the idea of practicing somatic philosophy, even when I do, sometimes I have to use words to doing something, and then like let's say I use journaling afterwards often to kind of reflect.
Yes,
Well, but that's
that's
word-based.
yeah.
And so I'm using one world, one tool, that the tool of words to work in a somatic field that is very clearly not words. And doesn't gel perfectly with the words I have in the language that I use. Like practically speaking, okay, whatever. It's what I have right now, so I'm going to use it. But on a like question level, it makes an interesting question to ask, okay, so what's the relationship there? How come we can observe that some of our very, very early versions that maybe don't have a full engagement or a full adaptation to this modality of words yet seem to like have so much of a more deep, more alive connection to the somatic level of being? Just kind of, yeah, that kind of makes me wonder.
Yes. And it makes me want to ask the question, what is a life? What is a human life?
Huh, interesting.
And with the being a I talked to Kelly Pride about what a person is, what is a person? Oh, yeah. And I told her that when I was pregnant, I was looking and feeling my big belly, and I was thinking there is a person in here, in my belly.
Yeah.
And it's such a so profound, it's almost not sayable. None of these things. That's all. It's okay. So I'm jumping back to when you say it, reflection and writing, and that after the experience, you want to reflect, and you often and writing is a way to do that. And writing is also like, and that's another thing we do with writing. We can go back and read it later, and then we can revise and see that no, I want to use this word instead, and no, that's not really what happened, and wait, I'm not accurate, or and then you can continue. So you can say, and these things mean, so like the hermeneutic interpretation function. It's also part of wisdom seeking and of recording and of bringing and of being able to tell someone else how to do it, and you know, like help to unlock someone.
It's funny. It makes me think like, oh, such a weird like duality that exists there, because you know, like on one hand, yes, exactly, it can be like something that, you know, can help someone else wake up, and that can like sort of spread things, like, you know, it's like the ability to be like, here, this was in my head, and like I can kind of like give that to you now, and then you can like put it in yours, so to speak. And at the same time, when you say like reflection and recording, I'm like, yeah, what an like profoundly different way than if like we assume that we don't have that, because somatically we don't.
Mm.
We have memory, but memory very much isn't the same as
record.
Looking at a word, because we know that our memories change in our heads.
Mm.
So therefore, I wonder, like, you know, there's like this, I don't know, there's this interesting intersection, because I can write something in my journal and I can look at it later, and from a later perspective, I see a whole new perspective of what I wrote there, maybe, or I make new connections. So if I didn't have that, though, if I had to engage with something somatically, and if I wanted to then re-experience it, I would have to engage with the same thing again somatically.
Mm.
It, like, you know, it sort of, it bars me from having this perfect recording, or it's not perfect, but close to, this static recording. It doesn't allow for that. And I'm, you know, it just makes me wonder, like, that probably really shapes very profoundly how we engage with something.
Yes. And it tells us something about time.
Yes.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, I'm jumping again here. Now I was thinking about what happens when we read, because I can say with full certainty that reading, like, certain books have changed my life, you know.
Yes.
No question about it. And then it's just what happens when you read. So this is super interesting. I can also say that I have, during my big crisis when I was 33, I wrote my journal copiously all the time. And then at one point I started reading through it, what I had written in the past 6 months. And I figured it was almost the same thing over and over and over and over again. And that obviously, that was like the, that's when things started changing, when I realized that I was, I had to do something else. You know, and then I'm thinking about the title of this book by Bessel van der Kolk, and it's called The Body Keeps the Score. So this So this is me writing the same thing all the time. So writing is obviously not the same as reading, because when and the body kept this. The body knew that the body. Oh, the writing was kind of the body's. Wait, no. So I'm thinking it was no catharsis, because it didn't come out. The body kept the knowledge. The body needed to do something else and change. Otherwise, the message was just came out the same way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that actually reminds me on like something that I'm very much kind of experiencing all the time, where it's like, well, you probably know what it feels like when you have like a never-ending growing reading list of all the interesting things that you find. And then,
yes.
You know, some of the books that I'm reading, I sort of, like, I get to a section And then I find a piece of information or data there that I want to integrate.
Yeah.
But then I can't read further because it feels, I don't know, it feels weird. Like it feels like I have to get this done first to have this integrated
Yeah.
before I can read on.
Yes.
And then so I have like several books started, and then I'm sometimes I get stuck at that point because I'm like, well, I'm not sure how to integrate this. And when it's a very profound piece of data that I want to integrate, it makes so many ripples that it can take like months or years until I feel like, oh, I integrated it now, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's almost like, okay, when I did, I can keep reading, or I might read the whole book all over again. Because, you know, why not? And then it's like, yeah, I'm thinking like, oh, interesting. I need to figure out how to get something in my body so much, but it can be an obstacle because sometimes, you know, sometimes I think at least it might just be better to just read the whole book and then integrate the different pieces. But because of this integrating process, for me at least, being something that has to happen so conscious, so like actively, then yeah, then I'm like, okay, so isn't that kind of what I said earlier? Isn't that sort of like figuring out how this data point can now be integrated into my somatic library? And when you're dealing with like complex stuff, like what you said, you know, like reading a book, like The Body Keeps the Score, there's like so many things in there that are, like you say, life-changing and completely can put like concepts upside down, where it feels like, yeah, I could probably do that for the next 20 years. And well, I don't know, maybe that would be great, but maybe it wouldn't be a great idea to only be doing that for the next 20 years just so that I, you know, have finished integrating before I keep reading, kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, I'm reminded now of a friend of a friend who has a podcast here in Swedish, and he said that he had been to see like an astrologer or something when he was in his 20s. He's now 50 plus, so maybe even 60. And the astrologer has said, "Oh, you're going to be a great astrologer with lots and lots of knowledge, but it will take you a very long time to integrate it." So he just started reading, and I think like, you know, 25 years later, he started using this knowledge. Yeah. So that can also be. I tell myself sometimes, I'm like, it's okay, because I also do this with the books, and especially if I have books that have you know, Übungen that they want you to do, these practices. Do this now. Spend 5. And then I'm just so eager to continue reading. So I'm like, okay, I'll just keep reading a little bit, and then I finish the entire book and I forget to do the exercises. So I haven't done all of them. And then yeah, so that's I do that quite a lot. So now I've started to at least give like 2 minutes to each of these exercises, even if I don't do exactly what they tell me to. But that's
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
but then I tell myself something is sticking, something is coming in, something will accumulate from this.
Yeah, well, you know, that reminds me a lot of like one core area of sort of my professional work as a coach is to work with creatives, right? And then it's like we just had yesterday, we had this like super fun group call, and I was hosting it, and we talked about creativity for like 4 hours or so, and it was very fun. And then some of the things that emerged there that are like, you know, also essential in, I don't know, it feels to me by now sort of like basics that I learned. It was hard to learn, you know, not because of anything specific, just because some lessons aren't sticking, like you say, you know, not right away. It needs like a sort of repetitive kind of continuous process. And we were talking a lot about the creative process, and an essential aspect of the creative process, you know, the way I understand it, is high volume. And high volume is independent of skill or talent a necessity for creating something that is, outstanding, that is like
Yes,
great.
it is.
And then when you speak about these like exercises, or like Übungen, which is funny, is that what you say in Swedish?
No,
Because that's
we
what you
say,
say in German.
yeah, I said it in German because it's we say Övningar. I just couldn't think of the English word, so it's always
Right.
yeah.
Yeah. So, it's been like it's like a constant field of my work to kind of in my own artistic practice and in like developing creative practices with other people to kind of go back to this factor of consistency and why is it important and why is it valuable, and kind of like you say, there's a like I have by now a lot. I was a strong sort of counter advocator for that, and now I've sort of switched sides for these like you say, 2 minute, 5 minute, 10 minute exercises, but they're for like every day without without fail, no need to get dogmatic about it, obviously, but this consistency has a process that in my experience it directly corresponds with the somatic aspect. Because,
Oh, this,
in creative language, I would say, oh, actually, no, this is funny. So it's not creative language. It comes from something that I like actually very much somatically experienced. So there is a wonderful guy who's into, into movement in general, like how you move the body. And there's like a whole sort of field of like that just calls itself movement and not any particular thing. His name is Ido Portal. He is like a wonderful resource if you want to see like a very physical adaptation of somaticness, I think. He's an interesting history. I don't know. I don't think he has a book, but he's sort of on Facebook and YouTube and you'll find him. Media representation is a little bit weird, but I came across him sort of from the aspect of parkour and free running back then. And he had like at some point said, well, you get better at what you do. And so you need to do a lot. And that's the consistency piece. And the interesting part of it that came out of that, and I think some other resource where I heard it too, is you also get better at what you don't do. So if you don't paint every day, you get better at not painting. And that's like a really like simplistic but super profound piece for me that I always try to keep in mind when I'm like working on developing like consistent patterns on my for myself or for people, because habituation is such a like neurologically and practically interesting thing for humans. So much that goes into it, but this piece of consistency seems to also not just work in habituation cognitively, but to do something to our somatic experience. So I think our bodies inform the cognitive aspect, like I sort of feel like with these little exercises that I do in whatever area, suddenly what happens is my body reminds me to do those. My body has somehow, formed a habit and kind of like a physical experience that then leads to a desire to do certain things. And I don't only experience that in the, oh, I remember it's like, I don't know, I hear this signal or it's this much like this is the time or whatever, and that's always when I do blah. It's more like when I don't do it, I have a somatic response in my body that is like a craving for that particular thing, whether it is like, reflecting or physical exercise or meditation or, whatever actually. And then that's like something that originated for me in the work of like developing a creative process, but then actually branched out into like a universally applicable tool that connects to somatic philosophy, which is the consistency of re-experiencing, and that might actually link up quite well with what we said about writing and the perfect record. Because if you have a consistent experience every day, it allows you to reflect and re-engage with quote unquote the same, but every time from a new, in a slightly new way, in a new form. And so that brings in diversity and a certain level of like permutation. And maybe that is like, maybe that is sort of the lift of the limitation that that language would pose on a somatic experiencing if you were to engage in it purely from a language level.
Yeah, I'm thinking here I have the Julia Cameron book, The Artist's Way. She has this kind of prayer in it. She says, God, you will give the quality and I will put up the quantity. I will put in my hours. So that's very nice. And then I think the former Nobel Prize for Literature Committee chairman guy, he also said that he was interviewed on TV at some point and about asking what books you should read or something. And he said, just read as many as you can. It's really, it's quantity, not quality, because then you'll be able to tell. And it's lovely. It sounds very funny from him, but it's
It's funny also, right, how like we have like kind of coming back to the idea of civilization and culture, we have like currently in our society such a high like focus on quality over quantity, where I think if we well if we time travel a little bit, sure, there has been like in the 20s and further on the kind of through the discovery of mass production and so on, there has been like a focus on quantity for a while, and then there's always the natural counter movement of going into the other extreme. But it's interesting to be like, if you look at, I don't know, Google results or something like that, which I always find a funny indicator of what the world is thinking about, like the rankings, and then it's like there's a lot of what is the best, like that's a very prevalent thing currently. What's the best, whatever, way to do blah, way to lose weight, way to get workouts, way to make art, way to whatever. It's like, it's the best, the best, the best. And that seems to like, it seems to reflect this desire of the world to have a higher quality. And at the same time, maybe the subconscious or conscious belief that there must be a shortcut, or there must be a different way, because the way of consistency, the way of putting in the hours, like you said in the, from the book, The Artist's Way, seems to be like, it seems to be like kind of the magical entrance gate that has worked for generations in, in all fields of creation, like science or art or whatever, anything that is like innovation driven kind of has that, where that seems to be a consistent message we're getting from the people who have quote unquote made it, being like, yeah, it's about quantity. Like, just do as much as you can, the rest will, somewhat fall in place. I would not agree that that's all there is to it, but I would say it's a really essential piece.
And there's a there's this lovely piece from this philosopher who talked about philosophy with children and how to do that. And he said that we often read about the great inventions, and but we have no idea how they came about, what happened before, and the road there. So it's yeah, it's like we're looking for the shortcuts and we're looking for I mean, we're looking for shortcuts, and we live in the sense of a constant hierarchy. Like, where am I? Am I climbing one step now in comparison to you? Nee, nee, nee. Who did it quicker? Who did it better? And
Yeah, and those things seem to kind of get emphasized, right? Like we have a sort of very strongly performance-driven approach, and in certain fields, like we were saying that in the call yesterday, it's like, nobody talks about the scientists and how many experiments and research hours go into just finding out what doesn't work. But it is like without that, you never do find out what does work. And but that's not something that you that you get exposed to necessarily. Like we said in our early on education and like contact with society, we speak about all the great inventions and what's faster, better, and like everything that's sort of like on that level, but very little about what goes into it. And actually, that might relate back to somatic intelligence because, any somatic intelligence level, even just, the one that probably most people have engaged with at one point of, let's say, working out and watching what it takes for your body to get to whatever your goal is, whether and that informs us, that provides us with that information of quantity being necessary. Because you can't just work out one day for 10 hours. It's not going to give you what you want, and instead of like doing 10 days of an hour each, there is this sort of aspect of process that, of ongoing process of everything being in motion and under constant change, being a core aspect of what life is. And that seems to be like much more hands-on, sort of in your face, if you engage with stuff somatically, while if you engage with it, purely on a thought level, you can discard that because you have the ability to jump time and space in your thoughts and just at the achievement, just look at the result, but not at the way.
Yes, this is another very important point for me personally, because I know that I have always looked for the timeless,
Yes.
and now it's more a wanting to be in time.
And I think it's really good to look at the re-experiencing not as a repetition, because that can like quickly make it into like, into something that I would think of as like not interesting, because it's like my mind instantly goes like, oh, like you mean like no new data? Boring. Like, when actually, when we talk on a like somatic level, that can't happen. Nothing that you do quite like that you do twice can actually not provide new data, because we exist, like you say, in time, and we are never in the same point in time twice. Therefore, the data is always different, and therefore it's always interesting. As we keep changing, so does our experience, so to speak.
And
And
we're always
it would, oh,
sorry again.
like I was just gonna say, like, I know I like used to think that way in the past often, and now I keep thinking back, and it's like, oh, that was quite arrogant of me to think that I could repeat an experience in that way, and that just because I had done it once from one perspective in my life, doing it again wouldn't provide me maybe with something amazing.
And one of the very first things you said was about the inquisitive nature to ask questions of the body and the physical experience. And this is the practice of somatic philosophy, this curiosity and inquisitiveness.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's like it comes back to that, like somewhere in between you had asked the question of what's a life, or like, you know, what is a person? And while I think person is maybe a little too complex to define right now, like life for me, you know, comes back to that. I think life is in a way similar to what I call creativity in a way, because it's about connection. It's there's a connection that is both life itself and also that makes a connection to life. So while I can't exactly define what a person is or like what me, quote unquote, is, I can say that the way I experience what life is through any kind of connection. And if we look on it from the somatic level, that we can't stay fixed in time and that nothing can be a repetition, a perfect repetition, then any engagement that I do is a communication, you know, an exercise of that connection to life. So that's kind of how I would put or like look at life in a somatic context.
That's a great last sentence.
Yay!
Yeah. Wasn't that nice? What is a life? A boomeranging connectivity. You can find this and all other episodes on philoprax.se. That's philoprax.se. And then we continue talking a bit about our cognitive functions and the pulsing stages of the day. That's another level of somatic philosophy, eh?
It's like it's cool how you mention the like cognitive phases.
Yes.
Can you really feel them like that?
I can feel it depends on sort of when I get up, but yeah, pretty much. And I think it I started feeling very, very clearly when I tried to meditate like using this app about 2 years ago, and I tried to do it in during my extroverted thinking phase. It was just impossible. I was questioning everything. I just wanted to sort of take the headphones off and start calling someone and saying, "You know what she said? You know, yeah, so that so I think I can. Yeah, it's just the last my last one is extroverted sensing.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sort of make itself known that clearly. It's sort of all the time, I think. And the yeah, and so some when it skips from one to another, it's not always that clear, but I can it, certainly in the sort of in the work during the working day, like between 10 and 3, I am pretty much I know which ones I'm in because
Great.
it's
Oh,
yeah.
that's really inspiring to me because these cognitive sort of processes are something that like I use them a lot with clients and stuff,
Yeah.
but I haven't been able, you know, like I was always like, okay, so my days are not that consistent, so it's difficult for me to track what state I'm in, but I've been wanting to utilize that more. And so if like, you know, if you could develop a feeling for which one you're in, and that's inspiring because that's like, oh, okay, cool. Maybe I can do it that way. Like, you know, through sensing which area I'm in at the moment.
Yeah,
Because I've been wanting to utilize that more.
the easiest way is to check, do I feel really now feel like calling someone and talking about it? Because
Right.
I'm extremely introverted. I'm an INTJ, so
Ah,
I'm
I see.
really, really introverted when I'm introverted, and then I really want to talk about it. I have this, like Karin also said, this extremely narrow perfect line of being not under or overstimulated. So,
Oh yeah. I thought that
yeah.
was excellent. I kind of have that too, only that like like you say, you know, I need to figure out what window I'm in to kind of know, because of the line being so thin, you know, when you don't know which window you're in, it's really easy to step off that like thin line, that thin path.